All right, we're on to part two of natural swimming pools. We wrapped up part one because Skype said so. Anna, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good.
All right.
What were we talking about when Skype so rudely interrupted us?
We were talking about, I believe, vertical walls and why we needed them, and then different possibilities to have less vertical walls, one of them being cedar, cedar logs to use to build the walls. And I was about to say that one of the reasons I think that vertical walls are popular is because you have a limited space in people's backyards, and oftentimes swimming pools are in backyards because in the country you are more likely to have a pond. And this allows you to have a deep swimming spot with shallow wetlands all in a really confined space, because if you had to have those wetlands slowly slope down to your 2 or 3 meter deep bottom of your pool, it would, you know, take up 2 or 3 times as much space.
True.
And then the other thought I had was that unless the wetlands were, you know, uniformly covered with, you know, lotus and lily pads that protected against the sun, you'd have a bigger area exposed to water heating that is shallow. That could be an issue. And then the third reason I thought we had vertical walls is the tradition. I mean, these are supposed to mimic real swimming pools. And so when we're mimicking something, we're trying to make it look like it as much as possible. And I think people feel like more like they're in a swimming pool if they see a wall.
Right. Now, I suppose that the thing is that the design that we have here is like solving 20 problems in one go.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to be able to pull it off, there's a certain level of orchestration that had to happen in the design. And so then, because part of the thing that I'm thinking of when I think of like, okay, I would like to do this a bit differently, is I want to eliminate the felt and the EPDM.
Uh-huh.
And I want to use Sepp Holzer's techniques for sealing a pond. So a lot of times Sepp Holzer comes in, is brought in, and people say, this pond here has turned out to be lame, and it's got a liner in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing he does is he rips out the liner, and he seals it his way, which is linerless.
Uh-huh.
And Sepp Holzer draws his techniques from pigs.
Uh-huh.
He, and it's not that he has pigs actually seal it, but he has observed how pigs will seal an area, and then he just takes that in order to seal up a wallow, and then he just takes that same knowledge, and then he applies it to ponds, and he has had tremendous success with this. And and now granted, it's different based on all kinds of different soil types and things like that. But if you've got a lot of clay, it's like a slam dunk. It's really easy to seal almost anything if you got a lot of clay. It's just hard to build a dam that will stay put when it's made out of clay and it's got water on it.
Yeah.
Because it tends to want to become something else and go away.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing I would like to see done, perhaps, and then when I think about Sepp Holzer's techniques, which are oftentimes bring in a big track hoe, dig your hole with the big bucket, and then when the time comes to seal it, you put the smallest bucket on the biggest track hoe, and then you go around and you compress the soil.
Mm-hmm.
You turn the bucket in such a way that it's like the knuckle of the bucket is pushing against the ground. And then you push down on it so hard that the front of the track hoe comes up.
Right.
And then you move over a foot and do it again. And you move over a foot and you do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And you do that over the surface of the whole pond, thus sealing the pond.
Mm-hmm.
Now, take that idea and combine with that the whole rammed earth structure thing, where they've got these ways of packing the soil so freakishly tight that they basically have walls that they've built.
Uh-huh.
And so I kind of wonder, what would happen if you did that, you know, in your ponds? You compress the soil so much that you effectively made the seal, much like what Sepp Holzer does.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, you somehow were able to pull it off to be able to do this with the walls. I would think the water would erode that, but you know what? It's maybe it wouldn't.
You mean if you didn't have a liner?
Right. I'm saying I'm going liner free.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think liner free thoughts.
There's probably a regular slope that you can have in a pond based on various soils. And maybe Seb Holzer can go a little beyond that with his technique. But I don't think you could get close to vertical with a liner. I think you might with the right soils if you got lucky.
Yeah, I am thinking that close to vertical wouldn't work out. I am kind of thinking about how those rammed earth walls work, mm-hmm. and it's like they'll put down like a foot of material. And then do the smash,
mm-hmm.
and then they'll put down another foot of material and do the smash, and they smash it so much that the material ends up only 4 inches thick.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm kind of thinking, wow, you know, would that work here?
You don't have water running through that material, though. So
right, it's still. But then you've got the propeller action of the teeny tiny children feet going against it.
Yeah. I don't know what that slope is.
Child erosion.
Right. Hey, that's big. Another concern with using just regular ground is what is the nutrients that you're going to get from that. And that's another thing in Littlewood's book that he says you can't do it with, you know, you can't just have your water open to the soil underneath because there's going to be too many various nutrients. But I know that's not true because I know that my friend Steve Heckeroth has done it, and he actually has groundwater as his source of water because he dug his pond over a little near a little spring or something. So
you've mentioned the word of one of the gods in my world, or the name of one of the gods in my world. So now you've got to tell everybody who Steve Heckeroth is.
All right. Well, I know he's one of the solar gurus, and I'm not sure specifically what his contribution in solar that makes him a guru is. But I also know he's a designer of homes and kind of architectural engineering stuff that uses energy efficiently. One of the things he's done is built a very large natural swimming pool. I think it's around a million gallons or maybe a little bit over that. It's about 20 feet deep, and it has perched wetlands up above it. It used to just be a regular pond, and he turned it into a natural swimming pool by adding a lot of cement on the walls to stabilize them. They're not vertical, but they're close to it, and then leaving the bottom open to the soil where it gets its water from. And that's a question I have, because I know that you're normally not supposed to build ponds with a spring at the bottom because it can also drain them. So I'm not sure the details on that.
I know a little bit.
Yeah, okay, well, we could get to that. But anyway, by having his wetlands perched and separate, he's able to drain his water through a dam that he has. So he does have a drain, and he has like a 1 or 2 acre field below that for agriculture. And that way he can keep, you know, he can still have his wetlands have water and still use a lot of that water body. And then what's even cooler is he has a stairway that goes down next to a dock, and the dock floats on whatever level the pond is. So as the pond goes down, you can still have good swimming access. So that is that project.
So Steve Heckeroth is the guy who years and years and years ago came up with an excellent electric tractor design.
He did have an electric tractor, yeah.
And I believe he's built a bunch of them.
Yeah.
And he's not only was it, you know, a solar thing, so it like didn't even need any power from the grid or anything like that. But even more, it was a 45 horsepower tractor, which I'm thinking, because 45 horsepower is kind of like this magic number in the tractor world,
mm-hmm.
where it's like there's a lot of stuff that doesn't work unless you have 45 horsepower.
Ah.
And so he hit that magic number with a tractor, which was so fascinating because a lot of times, you know, you use the 3-point hitch on the back to, like, you know, carry a certain implement.
Uh-huh.
And so you're, like, as you're going along, you're doing stuff, and you're, like, leaning over the back, looking over the back to see how things are going. And sometimes it's actually beneficial to drive the tractor backwards. It's like if you've got a mower, it's better to mow before your wheels get to it and mm-hmm. knock it down. And so he rigged it up so you could flip the seat around and drive it that way.
Uh-huh.
And which I thought was brilliant. But then, like, the entire controls for the tractor can fit into the palm of your hand.
Uh-huh.
So he had it rigged up so you could also sit like in the belly of the tractor and plant stuff as the tractor's crawling along.
Oh, wow.
And you could also, if you wanted to, mm-hmm. take the controls away from the tractor and drive the tractor around like a remote control car.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. I've seen them, but I haven't seen them in use.
And I'm thinking, this is just too awesome. And then, of course, with a lot of tractors, the thing is that you'll load the tires up with calcium, which is a liquid thing, to add weight to give it more traction.
Oh, uh-huh.
But in his original designs, of course, you got all these lead acid batteries, and he's got them so low that you've got this awesome low center of gravity for when you're doing hill work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, that thing is not going to roll. And then he's taken all of that. So basically, this 45 horsepower tractor, like, had this shape of a flat thing.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it. Another cool feature was that he had like one or two batteries that stayed on the tractor all the time, and the rest of the batteries are part of a battery pack.
Mm-hmm.
So you could like take the tractor over, and then you do something, and then it lowers the battery pack,
mm-hmm.
and this disconnects the battery pack. Then you drive the tractor over with the two remaining onboard batteries, and pick up a new battery mm-hmm. pack that could have been charging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because like with electric vehicles, the problem is like if you're going to go on a big long trip, you got to stop and recharge your vehicle.
Right.
But the tractor never goes all that far away from the barn.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and then plus you usually drive it back, to sleep at night anyway, and then mm-hmm. you can just recharge it.
Right.
Or if you're going to try and run something 24/7, well, you just have an extra battery pack.
Mm-hmm.
So one's getting recharged while you're out doing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So this layers and layers of brilliance. But on top of it, the new tractor that he's done are on tracks, and they're tiny. They're little tiny tractors, and they have 45 horsepower.
Uh-huh.
And it just shows the power of a genius such as himself with the electric tractor idea.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, boy, electric goes with tractors so much better than diesel or gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
It's just remarkably awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And So when you say the name, I start thinking about, hey, I wonder if I could take the time to drive down there. You know, I start getting all these ideas of like, you know, should I burn fuel to go and see? Well, all right, so Steve Heckeroth is your neighbor, you say?
Well, not my neighbor, but he's in the county. He's on the coast, and I'm inland.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I went to high school with his kids, so I just kind of know him a little bit.
Well, that's 100 times more than I do.
Yeah. So, well, anyway, the pool was very innovative as well, and really pretty exciting that he built. So it just kind of, he broke a couple of the rules and had great success, and I was glad to see that because it just means that everything's a little bit more flexible than we're led to believe.
Well, as you talk about that, and there's and we're talking about vertical walls.
Mm-hmm.
I have another concern.
Uh-huh.
And this is something where my concerns are vague, although I've read it from about six different sources, but I don't recall exactly, you know, what my concern is based
uh-huh.
on. But that's the idea of using cement in an area where you're going to have wildlife of any kind, like in a natural pond or in a pond that you're going to have on a farm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one idea is to use cement in order to be able to, you know, either have your dock or to be able to have a dam or something like that. My understanding is not a good idea. There's certain properties in the cement, even when it gets to be pretty old, like mm-hmm. it gets to be 5 years old, it's not as, I'm going to use the word toxic. It's not as toxic on the water
mm-hmm.
as something that's fresh cement, like only a few weeks old. But it's still not good. And maybe you have more understanding about concrete in aquaculture situations than I do.
Okay. I don't have a complete understanding, but I have a couple things to say. I know that in natural swimming pools, it is supposedly better to use EPDM than cement because I believe it has phosphorus in it, and that is a nutrient that can produce algae. And also, I believe that it has a lot more pore space for algae to grow and such. So I think you can seal it so that in terms of your water right then and there, you're all right. And that also, you don't have to seal it. My understanding is that in most systems, you can get away with a cement and then added phosphorus. But that doesn't really address your question of, is it a contaminant in other ways? So I'm not sure about that. But I've heard it's not really a problem in terms of the aquatics in the pond, in terms of toxicity, just in terms of nutrients.
So now, my understanding is that there is a toxic element to it.
Uh-huh.
And that it's one of those things where, like, if you're trying to build a pond that'll have fish in it,
mm-hmm.
as well as aquatic plants,
mm-hmm.
that if the level of cement per gallon of water reaches a certain level,
mm-hmm.
it's like nothing will live in the pond.
Interesting. Well, it's very basic. That's another aspect.
That's always been my impression, but then I think that stuff that I read said, no, it ain't that, it's something else.
Huh.
Maybe it's like something else and the basic thing and maybe a list of other things.
Yeah, maybe.
But I do know that the general observation is that cement or growies, so your garden or whatever, typically does not care for cement. When
uh-huh.
it gets up to the cement, it's like, ew, and it's not a big fan. Of course, when the cement gets older, it tends to be a little bit more bold, and tree roots will actually go and start breaking up cement.
Mm-hmm.
But my understanding is that in a water situation, I mean, like if you have a lake and you have cement piers, or if you have a lake and you have a cement dam,
mm-hmm.
then it's like there's so much other water, it turns out to be that whatever toxicity it's bringing to the situation, it ends up being small.
Uh-huh.
But then it's like, okay, my thing is, or where I'm at is, I want to be better than that.
Mm-hmm.
I like the idea of creating an aquaculture that is far superior. I don't want something that's like getting by,
mm-hmm.
or the
right.
toxicity level is low enough that things aren't dying that much. They're just a little sad. And I much prefer the idea of something where like the life in the water is thriving and vibrant and awesome and huge.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm nervous about the tires, I'm nervous about the cement, I'm nervous about the EPDM, I'm nervous about the felt,
mm-hmm.
that poly petroleum based
yeah.
felt
yeah.
that they were able to attach by melting it a little bit.
Right.
So I kept seeing things going into the system. I'm nervous. I'm even nervous about those pipes, but it's like, you know, whenever you have a pond, you're going to have some pipes,
yeah.
and there's not a whole hell of a lot you're going to do about that. But whenever I see the pipes, I think, at the very least, I want to protect the pipes from UV radiation so that way they might be more inert
mm-hmm.
for longer.
Mm-hmm. Right. And also, but so, that whole liner, that whole geotextile that was over the top of the liner is totally exposed to the sun all the time.
Yeah. So.
Well, actually, it had a layer of gravel over it. Parts of it are exposed to the sun.
Parts of it are exposed. I mean, especially the vertical walls.
Mm-hmm.
Those vertical walls are exposed.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of wonder, because the other thing is in version 1.0,
mm-hmm.
the first pond, he was using those sandbags that were made out of something plastic-ish.
Right. And they're already degraded.
Yes, it was like, what, 1 year later, and it's like if you touched them, they fell apart.
Yeah.
It's like, wow. And then that kind of led to this other thing where it's like, oh, okay, so for the next one, he's going to use burlap,
mm-hmm.
which I thought, okay, much better.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would put like a little bit of Portland cement mixed in with the sand,
mm-hmm.
So that way it would kind of like, you know, He would lay the sacks out, and then once they got wet, then they would start to cure
mm-hmm.
and then turn into a solid wall. And this is like something from Gavi Otis. I don't know if you've ever read the book Gavi Otis.
Uh-huh.
Oh, good. Yeah. So then this is a way that they made their ponds and stuff.
Right.
And Gavi Otis, they called it soilcrete or something
uh-huh.
like that. And Which I think, you know, in many ways is really smart, but once again, it comes back to my concerns about cement being part of something where, well, being part of your environment, you know. So if you've got a chunk of land, maybe it's only an acre, but if you're bringing in a bunch of cement as part of your natural environment, it sends up red flags for me, and yeah. I get concerns. Same with tires. You're bringing a bunch of tires, or if you're bringing a bunch of, you know, petroleum product stuff, then it's like, I'm a little nervous yeah. about that. I'd like to minimize that.
Yeah. Well, when I think of working with cement, you get it on your hands, it kind of burns, you know, and that's that basic quality. So that's the composition of the cement. It's a material that kind of burns. And then the other thought I have, I'm not coming up with a toxicity that you said of cement aside from that. And one other thing, which is radon, but I don't know the connection. But I remember buying a house once where we had a radon detector because of the cement. Are you familiar with that?
Well, my impression is that the radon doesn't come from the cement necessarily,
uh-huh.
but it's going to come from the ground. And some areas just happen to have radioactive gobbledygook going on in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So I posted out to Permies. There was this time a couple of years ago I was living somewhere, and it was a temporary place, and it was a basement-y thing. And I went and bought a radon detector, and it pretty much pegged it out, like at 10 times greater than the levels of get the hell out of the house.
Right.
So it's something that can cause cancer. It like turns you into you get cancer rates greater than being a smoker when the levels get high enough.
Wow. Well, I think that can be associated with cement somehow.
Well, yeah. I think that if you have radioactive-ish material in your cement, mm-hmm. like that's part of your aggregate,
mm-hmm.
then yeah, I think it could generate radon. But I would also imagine that you could also make cement that doesn't.
Okay.
But I'm going to claim ignorance on this, and that I'm going to qualify all of that is speculation.
Okay, I'm going to say basically about cement in general is that I'm not all that worried about it. I'm honestly a little bit more worried about petroleum products that break down in the sun in terms of contaminants. And that's partly speculation as well, and I'm actually interested to research this a little bit more. But that's my general idea right now, is that I'm not too worried about having a certain amount of cement in your pond.
All right.
Aside from the algal, you know, small issues, but not like nothing that I'm going to run screaming from.
And it does seem like I've seen algae growing on cement.
Yeah, it really likes it.
And so there are cases where stuff seems to be okay with it enough that it'll actually cling to it. So, you know, and then of course there's, well, anyway, I'm still of the camp that I'm nervous about it.
Yeah.
And yes, I would very much like to hear back about whatever research you might be able to do, mm-hmm. and what you've come up with. I like the idea that maybe in the future we'll do some more podcasts, you know, when we venture into these areas with you.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the next time we do one, then you'll have done that research and you'll be able to tell everybody about that.
That would be interesting. That would be fun.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Moving down my list, the next thing I saw was, you know, I marked it off as the poor man's water level, which I've used before, which is really fun and cool.
Uh-huh.
And then he came back to say that it's actually called a bunyip, which uh-huh. I've never heard before.
Yeah.
And so I thought, that's a cool sounding word. I like that.
I like that, too.
And so basically, so that folks will know, you basically have a piece of tube or whatever, and you got clearish tubish stuff on the ends, or maybe you've got like a clear jug taped to the tube on the ends, and you have water in it, and it acts as a level. And
mm-hmm.
so on one end, you got it all set up, and you can look at the water level, and on the other end, you're holding it up to something, and you can see what's exactly level
mm-hmm.
on both ends. And I thought it was funny how the old guy that they had in the video wasn't so sure that this would work.
Yeah.
And he was kind of, they were kind of tossing around the idea of maybe gravity is bigger on one end
right.
than on the other. And it's like, that's why when sometimes you go out and you look at a big lake,
uh-huh.
one end is lower than the other end.
Right.
So Anyway, still a hell of a thing, a bunyip. Mm-hmm. And so they got a good bunyip demonstration over and over again.
Right.
In this video. In fact, I should have mentioned that in part one. You got to go buy this DVD from Permanent Publications, which they're permaculture.co.uk. And I believe if you're going to buy it and then get it delivered into the States, I think it ends up being a total of about $30. Is that right?
I believe so.
Yeah, $30. So, which at this point in time, if nothing else, I think if you're going to build a natural swimming pool, I would say that this DVD is worth owning.
I would say definitely if you're going to build it yourself. I would say it's a must. I would say if you're hiring someone to do it, then it's not. This isn't necessarily the one that you need.
Okay.
But if you're going to do it yourself, I think it's very great.
Okay, that's a powerful recommendation, a must. But I think it's a damn good idea to get it. All right, moving on to the list here. Let's see. Using the sand and gravel that they dug up for the aggregate with the cement. So they're trying to make their own concrete.
Uh-huh.
And so they have some bags of Portland cement. And so they're kind of doing a soilcrete-like thing. But when they dug this stuff up, a lot of what they got out of the hole was rather gravel-esque.
Mm-hmm.
So then they just took the stuff that got out of the hole, this gravel-esque stuff, and then they had a little sifteroo there, and then they just kind of sifted it by hand, and then they ended up with a finer aggregate,
mm-hmm.
which then they used to make their concrete. So you mix Portland cement with gravelly, sandy stuff, and you end up with concrete.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they made their own for wherever it was they felt like they needed to have some.
Mm-hmm.
Then they basically made their own, right? Which I thought was a great thing. Good reuse.
Mm-hmm.
Better than buying sacks or having a cement truck come or something like that and bring a load.
Yeah, there was excellent reuse with that throughout the video.
Yeah, I liked that. They had a rainstorm during the construction, which caused all kinds of problems.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, they dug these nice steep walls, and then the idea is they're going to build their cement walls or cement block walls, which in fact, this is a good time to point out, I don't think those cement block walls are going to hold.
I was concerned about them being strong enough, too. But they might, because then they're going to put a liner over it. So if they're always full, there's always going to be that water pressure pushing out. And that's why I was saying if you have a liner, you might get away with vertical walls without as much support because you don't have any erosion and you always have your water pressure pushing up on that direction.
That is a very good point. That is a very good point. I hadn't thought of that.
Mm-hmm.
When I was thinking about the water being on both sides, I was kind of thinking that the pressure to push it into the water would be greater. But you're right. With that liner, then the pressure that's coming from inside is probably even greater than the pressure coming from the sand on the outside.
I would say so. I would say even if you had super high groundwater, then I think that they would just be like equal or something like that. I don't think the outside pressure would ever exceed the inside pressure.
Right.
Unless you emptied it. Although if you had high groundwater, you'd be having other problems that could cause it to collapse. But
true.
Like floating
true.
Liners, but yeah.
Right, but yeah, but it did seem clear that he's not designing it with the idea of it ever being emptied, too.
Right.
So that might be part of the design. That's a very good point. Okay, let's see. Finer sand for mortar. So they screened their stuff even more to make the mortar. And the mortar that they did was a kind of mortar with cement in it as opposed to a mortar that's just clay and sand. Mm-hmm. So so they are trying to get it to be something a little bit stronger.
Right. Well, he learned his lesson on this first pool where he didn't use cement. So.
Yeah. I guess it is, because they did say at some point, it's like the race is on, you know? They seem like they were oftentimes racing the weather. Like, you've got to hurry up and do this before the weather makes a big mess.
Yeah, I think that he might have succeeded with those sandbags in that first pool if he hadn't have had a weather problem. Because of that pressure of the water. I'm not sure, but it seems possible to me.
I think one thing that they demonstrated in this, which I struggled with on the first pond I ever built, was separating the topsoil. And when I went to go build my first pond, I knew about separating the topsoil, and I knew that you had to do it, that it was important. But it's like once you're there and it's like, I want to hurry up and have a pond, then you start to think to yourself, can I do shortcuts and go ahead and mix some of this in here and there? And it's like, no. Separate all the topsoil, drag it far, far away, take the time to do it right. And they did. They did. They took the time to drag the topsoil farther away and not be tempted in using it in anything else. So they were very careful to make sure to separate their different types of materials, which is so important. So I'm glad that they had a good demonstration of that. Let's see, boy, a lot of on my list here we've already covered. Packing. Oh, they had a tool. They have this tool where it's got like this 2-inch square base on it. Maybe it was a 2.5-inch square base, and then a big rod on top of that. And that's what they're packing with. And I'm thinking, that doesn't pack worth a damn.
On the first bigger pool he built?
No, on the second
one. Oh, that tiny camper, right.
They've got this big steel rod so that they can jam it down into the ground. And the base, it flares out at the base. And it's got like this 2, maybe even 3-inch square that's kind of welded to the end of this rod, and that's the part where you're going to make things flat. And I'm thinking, no. Just have a rod with the because like the rod looked like it was probably the better part of an inch thick.
You're saying that that's enough, and then that's better for tamping.
Yes, just have the flat end of that rod.
Yeah,
and then that's going to pack the soil. You know, but that base was keeping the soil from being packed.
Yeah.
And, I mean, granted, it makes the surface look flatter.
Right.
Because if you use the rod's going to make the surface really uneven, but it's going to be packed. But that base is making it look flat, but it's not packed.
Right. I know what you mean, and I agree. And I would say I wrote down on my list just soils ? Because the whole thing didn't really go into soils very much, and I questioned how much they knew about soils, and it's just such an important aspect of building a pool, and soils vary so much that it's something to make sure you understand enough about before you get started if you want your pool to not collapse and have sinkholes and stuff.
It does seem like he learned a lot when it did start to collapse.
Right.
he got the education in the end.
Well, he had collapses on both pools, so he got some of it, maybe.
He's learning more every pool he makes.
And I also thought that he actually, I mean, it's hard to tell in a video, but just in looking at it, I thought he was pretty lucky with the soil type that he had. He seemed like he had a good amount of clay in there, but likely not too much. So it looked like it was pretty good structurally. So I would suggest that other soils might even be more difficult to work with. So don't expect it to go as easy as it went for him, and it didn't go easy for him.
Right. Yeah. It's a big gob of it depends.
Yeah.
And you're right. There's so many different kinds of soils. On the other hand, it's like a lot of this stuff could be simplified. Like you could come up with directions for doing this that can be simpler without a greater knowledge of soils. But you got to kind of have a guide of some kind to go by.
Right. Go ahead.
If you've got a 55-gallon bucket full of knowledge on soils, then I think you're going to have greater success in building a pond. But on the other hand, if you've got a coffee cup full of knowledge about soils, but it's just the right knowledge, I think you could still do just as good of a job as if you had the 55-gallon barrel, But it's like, you know, you've got just all that you need. And it's like you don't really, when you're getting started, you don't really know what it is you need to know in order to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of seems like, you know, between the video and the books by your friend Littlewood, is that right?
Yeah.
Then those together might give you just enough knowledge to be able to do a decent job.
I think so. And what I was going to just say about Littlewood's books is they have a lot of rules in them, like I mentioned, like it needs to be 3 meters deep, and you shouldn't use cement, you should use liner because of the phosphorus, and you can't use it without a liner, you can't just use, you know, the ground. And these, I don't think these are hardline rules, they're more that, you know, he's trying to make this concept mainstream, and you can pick up those books and follow the rules and build a pool and be successful. And so they're very good tools to have, whereas this video is more creative and more innovative, and it shows you, you know, like, hey, let's see if we can get away with this and see if we can get away with that. And he succeeds, and I think that's really neat. But I do think combined that they create a good resource. Because the things it says you shouldn't do in Littlewood's books, at least you realize I should consider not doing them, or I should find an expert, or I should, you know, make sure I have that knowledge before I decide to break this rule.
So the next thing I got on my list, which I thought was awesome, and I actually said this out loud, mm-hmm. and then like 30 seconds later, they said it in the video.
Uh-huh.
And that is, as they've got the pond liner, mm-hmm. and they're trying to place it in such a way that it doesn't end up wadded up and thus getting holes in it, because it's just one great big piece of rubber.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that, because the shape is not a flat shape. And so they're trying to fold the pond liner so that it can remain one contiguous piece of rubber.
Uh-huh.
That does not leak.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to fold it neatly because they're going to put stuff on it.
Uh-huh.
And they called it EPDM origami.
Yeah.
But, you know, so as they're trying to figure it out, I'm thinking, man, this is like doing origami,
yep.
with EPDM. And then he says, we call this EPDM origami.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I felt brilliant.
Right.
So let's see.
I've kind of finished everything on my list, so we'll go through yours.
I think I'm down to last two items. Oh, next item, introducing plants versus you just having patience and the plants will show up.
Mm-hmm.
So on all the ponds that I've ever built, I've never put plants in them.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of your pond plants just show up. And I always believe it's because, you know, ducks and geese and stuff are like, you know, they're at some pond that's full of all kinds of plants, and who knows what sticks to the ducks or what's running out the back end. And then the ducks are like, hey, let's go somewhere else.
Right.
And then they go and they fly, and they're like, hey, look down there, a pond.
Uh-huh.
And they land on my pond, and next thing you know, my pond has got all kinds of aquatic plant life coming out of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's been my experience. And then, in fact, he mentioned that while he planted a lot of stuff that you didn't need to,
mm-hmm.
and on top of that, a whole bunch of stuff that he never planted eventually showed up.
Mm-hmm.
So I imagine this is your area of expertise.
Well, I definitely think that things can show up, but I think that, I mean, it's my preference to plant certain things because I want certain things there. And also, invasive species are just as likely to show up as native species. So, I don't know. I would probably plant it myself. Also, there's a variety of different types of plants. And it's good to have a balance. Like, you want the lilies and the lotuses that are, their function is to kind of block the sunlight. And Anyway, I think it is good to kind of find the different balance that you want for your ecosystem and the different functions that they play, as well as like creating a beautiful gardenscape in your pool, because this isn't just a pool; it's an aquatic garden, and so there's a lot of opportunity to kind of, you know, pick different color combos or to place things in groups of three or groups of seven, and just kind of design your pool that way. But yeah, you can let it show up. It would take a while, I think, a couple years to get things going rather than maybe just a year before things are established and balanced.
So, Anna, how many of these natural swimming pools have you made?
I haven't made any yet. I've consulted on two, and I have one of them, the client decided not to build it because they just ran out of money, and the others was Steve's, and I consulted on his aquatic garden and gave him a plant list and such. So those, and then I've talked to a few other people about building and given a little advice, but nothing that has led to anything yet.
Okay, so like, you know, so what would you say is the thing that is your day job?
Well, I do so many different things, it's hard to say, but I've been designing and installing gray water systems and rainwater catchment, and then I also have been starting to work with stormwater, which is, I don't know if you're familiar with the new stormwater code. It's a national code that's coming out of the Environmental Protection Agency, but it's, I think, different state to state a little bit as well. So that's kind of a big deal that's really exciting right now. And then I also just do traditional watershed work, like hydrologic monitoring and stream restoration using like bioengineering and stuff. So that kind of work.
And that seemed like a lot of the kind of work that Mark Vandermeer does.
It does, and that's kind of where I came from, that doing that kind of work, and it's been it just in the last like 2.5 years that I've been trying to build my business in the more sustainable design and construction industry of water.
Okay, because I know when Mark and I get together and we don't record anything, that usually what we're talking about is stuff like, here's a dry gully, mm-hmm. and then he would talk about projects that he's done in the past where, okay, here's a dry gully, and we did all this stuff, and now the creek is back.
Right.
There's a creek there now, and it's a year-round creek, whereas, you know, before, it was all summer long, it was totally bone dry.
Exactly. That's what I have greater expertise in, honestly. I did that for, you know, 10 or 12 years, and it's only been the last couple years that I've been changing my focus a bit and not stopping doing that, just incorporating a bunch more stuff.
Okay. Any other things you want to say about this video we just watched?
Well, I guess I just found it. I enjoyed watching it. I enjoyed the guy's personality. I enjoyed that he showed his mistakes as well as his successes. I enjoyed the accent, and I enjoyed the children running around getting muddy. So it was a good watch, and I'm glad I got to see it.
I really enjoyed it too, and it does. If nothing else, it gets you excited about the idea of doing this.
It does.
And plus, yeah, I agree with you. I like the guy. It's just, how could you not like this guy?
Uh-huh.
He just seems awesome.
Yeah.
So, and I liked Barry.
Yeah.
this old guy all hunched over with bricks in his hand, and it's like, really, you're going to put Barry to work?
Right.
And it's like, nope. Barry's jumping right in. He's getting the work done. And it's like, I want to get Barry a chair.
Right.
You know, but I think Barry's not a chair kind of guy. He's a keep on working, you know. And so I enjoyed it. You know what? And for $30, $30 delivered to your home,
mm-hmm.
I thought this was a kick-ass thing. I thought it was well worth it.
Yeah.
Well worth $30. Easy. So, I think I need to go and get those books that you were talking about from Littlewood,
uh-huh.
and give those a gander too.
Okay.
I think that would be fun.
Yeah.
Because now I'm all tasted up. I want to do more.
Yeah. Well, his newest book is Regular Pool Conversions to Natural Swimming Pools. So that's a subject that is also interesting.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh, shiny.
Yeah.
All right, so that was Natural Swimming Pools, a DVD that you can get from Permanent Publications, permaculture.co.uk. And if you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about ponds and pools and homesteading and permaculture all the time.